Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Stock, for your welcome. Thank you also for the warm words of welcome from the Minister, from Sandra. It's wonderful to be here. And thank you very much to the organisers. I hope I can meet the brief which has been set to provoke discussion, to share ideas, and to help set our discussions on an even keel. What I want to do in the next 20 minutes is just to give you a short overview, really, of some of the issues and challenges associated with long-term access to data. And I suppose I could summarize my presentation in one slide. Perhaps Sandra would let me finish my presentation after this first slide by simply saying three things you need to know about this question of long-term access. And it's fairly straightforward. This question of long-term access won't go away. This is a growing problem, as we've already heard from Sandra. And it's not a problem that will fix itself. This is a problem that requires some level of intervention. So what I hope to do in the next 10-15 minutes or so is show you some of the interventions required, some of the opportunities that accrue, and really provide a basis for conversation. There's a great deal of research to summarise in this presentation, so we can certainly follow up subsequently. So let me start where digital preservation presentations always start. They typically make bleak reading. I am, by background, an archaeologist. Perhaps Dr. Stančić might recognize some of this research. In the late 90s, we asked academics in the United Kingdom, who were archaeologists, what they were doing with the research data that they excavated out of the ground. Remember, archaeology is a systematic risk to the historic environment. There's nothing more that archaeologists enjoy than systematically dismantling it. And consequently, the records we produce are, very important. And yet, in the late 90s, we asked our colleagues what they were doing with the data produced, and not surprisingly, there's little infrastructure and little effectively being done to protect the archaeological record. Very pleased, therefore, I was with a little quote right at the end of the report, which says that the archaeological record is in more danger in digital form than it ever was when in the ground. This is, I suppose, a typical place to start a digital preservation talk. We can do this several times over. Here's a more recent example. In the UK, a major funding body funding digitization asked us to ask those institutions what was happening to the data that they had funded at public expense for digitization. Some were able to give very straightforward answers. Some were unable really to give any precise answer as to what would happen at the end of the digitization project. A further example from the public sector, looking at the answers to parliamentary questions, so questions posed to ministers in parliament. And of all the websites quoted in parliamentary answers between 1997 and 2006, 40% of the links had now broken. And bear in mind, these are not a random selection of websites. These are websites quoted in parliamentary answers. This is a, this is how we keep, I suppose, government to account. This is a game that we could go on playing for a while, I suppose. So let's try a little experiment, if I can be so bold. Can I do a show of hands? Would that be appropriate? Show of hands of anyone in the room who has ever inadvertently lost a file that they were working on. I certainly have. And it's a story we can tell on a corporate level, but also at a personal level. So what should we do about this problem, which we recognise and which is widely shared? So I'm going to give you very briefly four classic responses, and then we'll talk about some of the challenges. So the classic response, the most used response, is a migration response, whereby we take a data set, we migrate it through subsequent versions of the file format wrappers. So a migration approach to preservation, which might be, I suppose, described as intervening at a data level to manage the data. A second response, quite widely discussed, but not much used in actual fact, an emulation response, which might be described as intervening at a software or operating system level, in order that we can retain access to the information, we retain access to the software, and by retaining access to the software, we need all sorts of plugs and tools to make sure that data or that software remains readable. There are also groups doing a hardware preservation approach. This is a tricky thing to do, because in order to preserve hardware, you need to preserve also the components, and you need therefore to be able to find additional spare parts. And finding spare parts for computers requires having a spare fabrication plant, and that becomes really problematic, or can be. But nonetheless, there are contexts where that still makes sense. And finally, it's fair to say that there are still emerging answers to this question. And quite a few institutions in Europe have looked at this problem and noted that it is itself a research problem. So in some sense, the answer to this question might yet be in the room and might yet come out of the discussions that we have today. So we should be alive to the reality that this is itself a research question, and the research community is therefore extremely well placed to contribute to this wider social question. Six challenges then, and I'm going to run through. These are very high level, as is necessary at this point in the discussion. But let's just talk through six high-level issues and how these have been approached by the preservation community. And we start with a kind of fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is that use of digital technologies depends upon a configuration of software and hardware and people, and software and hardware and people change. So what we need to do is to understand that configuration in some way and understand how that configuration has come about and how it could be, in some sense, reconstituted. And that, therefore, makes it a metadata question. It makes it a question of how we represent that configuration in such a way that it can be made sense of in the future. And there has been significant amount of research on how one captures that sort of metadata, and there are standards about capturing that metadata which sit alongside some of the more classic approaches to managing metadata for scientific research purposes. Secondly, let's realise that technology continues to change, and moreover, that change is not a bug. Change is actually a welcome part of the IT industry. But this creates the conditions for obsolescence. So what we need to do is to plan accordingly. And we have to recognise that current plans may need to be updated. In fact, they certainly will need to be updated as software and technology continue to emerge. And therefore, in this context, we need planning tools, we need systems which can deal with that ongoing change in technology. And in a fundamental sense, any institution that wants to get involved in long-term preservation will have to, in time, become a learning institution, because it will have to be constantly learning and relearning about the developments in technology. Storage media fail. Storage media have relatively short lifespans and are themselves subject to obsolescence. So storage strategies need to be developed which allow for refreshment, allow for material to be moved easily from one platform to another. Can I say it's often confused between storage and preservation? It's certainly the case at a hardware institution or in a meeting of engineers. The idea of storage is often completely misunderstood as being the solution to preservation. But there's much more to it than that. But fundamentally, we do need storage solutions. We can't live without them. And there are multiple solutions in this space too. The most quoted axiom in digital preservation, I suppose, is the lots of copies keeps stuff safe phrase from the Locks group in Stanford University. And how we achieve that has a variety of different technologies available. Preservation systems are themselves subject to obsolescence. This is, I suppose, a warning to those who would come and sell solutions off the shelf and allow you, encourage you to buy a single one-time and for all solution. The reality is the systems are themselves subject to the same obsolescence they're trying to address. Consequently, we need systems which are component-based and which are modular in such a way that small components can be plugged in and plugged out as required, and that those parts of the system can be tested accordingly. And we're going to hear later, I guess, from Dr. Dorn, we'll hear more about standards around, for example, the trusted digital repository. But there are standards in this space, and it's worth keeping track of the standards in this space, not least because there's a real risk in this growing community of fragmentation of those standards. And what we actually need to do is to pick up that best practice rather than reinventing best practice, especially if we can show that best practice being inscribed within standards. Digital resources are intolerant of gaps, so we can't put things on a shelf and expect to come back in 50 years' time and find that they're still there. In reality, we have lots of examples of where that's been presumed, but where that's not been possible to do. So we need to think about ongoing management of resources. And that lends itself to risk management. And there are different approaches to that long-term management. We can think about life cycle approaches. And this is where I think the funders have had a significant impact by, for example, mandating certain best practice at an early stage in project development. One creates the conditions where that long-term management becomes possible and realistic. But there are many other styles of approaches about thinking about long-term preservation or ongoing activity through time. And finally, thinking on challenges, resources can be corrupted or tampered without trace. And that means this world of digital preservation actually from time to time skirts close to the territory really now occupied by cybersecurity and by those fighting cybercrime. But it seems to me that some of the tools and technologies from the preservation community actually have things to offer to that wider economic set of challenges and vice versa. How do we understand fixity? How do we understand authenticity of data? There are a variety of tools in this domain, and research continues as to how one, for example, develops authenticity evidence records and so forth. So those are, I suppose, the four classic approaches and then six broad challenges, just intended to be provoking some discussion or getting some material together. What I want to say now is to take us back to why we do preservation and connect us back to some of the big policy drivers which we started today's presentations with. And it's an important message, I think, to take home, but it's a subtle message that needs carefully unpacked, that why we do preservation isn't because of data loss. Let me explain that in such a way that it can be understood. It's a risky thing, I realise, for someone who works for Digital Preservation Coalition to say out loud. But actually, there's something more subtle going on here that we need to be aware of. So what is the problem? Well, my observation would be fairly straightforward. Let's restate the issue of long-term access. And it seems to me, and everything we've heard so far tells us, that data has some value. It has creates opportunities. It creates things that we can do in the real world. We can use this data to, you know, help us with scientific research. We can use this for all sorts of social and economic purposes. And the data, therefore, has value embedded within the opportunities that it creates. But access depends on this configuration of software and hardware and people. and technology and software and hardware and people change. Therefore, the technology can create the barriers to reuse and exploitation of our data. And therefore, managing data in the long term protects and also creates and helps to transmit those opportunities from one generation to the next. My observation then, I suppose, is that we don't do digital preservation because of some desire to protect the data. We're doing it out of some desire to protect the opportunities that we see within that data. And we do it in the public sector, I suppose, for a bunch of reasons which are down to, I suppose, regulation or are down to policy requirements. Digital preservation, fundamentally, when you push back on the reasons as why we do it, it's about healthier and wealthier and smarter and greener and better connected communities and people and economies. And that's why it's worth investing in. That's why we want to take steps to protect this data, because in so doing, we protect those opportunities. And it's true also for the private sector, although the drivers may be different. Issues, for example, around regulatory compliance, around legal compliance, around legal protection. Here's a little fact for us for discussion. In the US in 2011, patent suit litigation, that is to say Microsoft suing Samsung, suing Google, suing Apple, all over each other's patents. Patent litigation in the US in 2011 reached $200 billion. That's 2% of GDP. This is a colossal problem. And the best way to protect yourself against that type of litigation is by robust records management and preservation and proving that you have title to the innovations you're behind. So, let me summarize what I'm trying to say then. Digital preservation isn't just about data or access or risk management. It's actually about people and opportunity. And when we talk about preservation, let's start there. Thank you very much.